Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. There is more to learn from flocks of birds and schools of fish than anything in a medical textbook about why we are the way we are and how to keep us well. Human animals haven't evolved far from our wild natures. We really are just a blip on the screen in terms of time, even though we take ourselves very seriously and are mucking things up for all other creatures very fast. But look under the surface and you find an animal. So it might make sense to look closely at how our roommates are handling the environmental exposures we share and observe the wisdom in how they raise their young, eat, procreate, medicate, and treat their peers. More now than ever before, it's time for us to see all life as a part of us so that we can protect all of us. First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. David Erdahl is a management consultant working in Britain. He advises workers on how to take over a company and run it as a cooperative. It's a booming business. It turns out that the cooperative sector in Britain is bigger than the agriculture sector. David Erdahl is a PhD in evolutionary psychology. In his latest book, Beyond the Corporation, Humanity Working, he promotes cooperatives, describing how and why they succeed because of our Neolithic hunter-gatherer humanity. In the book's final section, Humanity Flourishing, he describes a study he conducted in North Italy of three towns. In one, a quarter of the businesses are cooperatives. Another, at the other end of the spectrum, had none. The third was in between. The lifespan in the town with cooperatives is 2.5 years greater than the town without. The picture is the same for a wide variety of other so-called quality of life indicators at all measured. This isn't just the point that conditions at work affect your health. Erdahl is drawing a direct line between the social relations of production and health. I was introduced to David Erdahl's work by Bernard Marzalek, a co-founder of JazzyCon, Just Alternative Sustainable Economics, in response to our recent show on free play and unschooling with Peter Gray. Peter Gray, also a PhD evolutionary psychologist, draws a direct connection between the decline in children's free play in the last half of the 20th century and the rise of psychopathologies such as depression and narcissism. A surprise for me was that it was not technologies such as television and computers that accounted for the decline of free play. In fact, one study indicates that television watching has declined, not increased, but time spent in school, time spent doing homework, and time spent shopping with parents that were the major sinkholes for children's time. What also increased was the amount of play that was controlled by adults. Organized sports, lessons of this and that, and so on. Gray cites research showing how free play develops a child's interests and sense of competence, ability to make decisions and solve problems, learn how to regulate his or her emotions, make friends and learn to get along with others as equals, and just makes him or her happy, all of which are squashed with the decline in free play. Gray suggests that the same is true of adults. The thread that runs through the work of David Erdahl and Peter Gray is that their perspective is informed by our understanding of how our Neolithic hunter-gatherer past shaped who we are as social beings. David Erdahl describes three basic characteristics of the hunter-gatherer societies that preceded the rise of agriculture and with it civilization. First, strong rules about sharing. Second, a lack of permanent leadership. And third, a strong sense of fairness. All of these emerge in the act of free play, promoted by Peter Gray and embodied in the concept of unschooling. Erdahl and Gray are promoting social systems that make sense to our Neolithic biology and psychology. Erdahl for workers, Gray for the young. They are not promoting a biological determinism the way that apologists for the laissez-faire capitalism attempted to use Darwin to rationalize the misery inflicted on the working class as the natural outcome of survival of the fittest. It is more accurate to say that they promote better social outcomes informed by what I'd call Neolithic health. Yet the analysis of each man has its limits. In the case of Peter Gray, he has no adequate explanation for why children's lives have been so restricted. Perhaps it's because he limits himself, not surprisingly, to psychological explanations. What makes sense to me, not surprisingly, is that the decline of free play takes place in the context of a political economy that needs children to become a disciplined, working, and consuming class, and not just future tense, since children now are a consuming class of their own. What's missing from Gray's analysis is something like Paul Goodman's Growing Up Absurd, Problems of Youth in the Organized System, published over 50 years ago. Likewise with David Erdahl, who in a telling example describes a worker-owned company that thrives in a stagnant industry by using the humane environment created by the cooperative to increase productivity and lower costs by laying off workers. For cooperatives, the context is that the individual enterprise might be idyllic, but it is still subject to the laws of motion dominated by capitalist production, laws which are very much not humane. There's a further dimension that reconnects in a very direct way with health outcomes, the actual object of production. Would Monsanto be less toxic if it were a worker-owned cooperative, Dow Chemical, Exxon? But these are only limits. We should be inspired that people are seeking the cooperatives advocated by David Erdahl and the unschooling advocated by Peter Gray in growing numbers. Perhaps our Neolithic humanity will prevail after all. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our topic today, our animal nature, and our guest, who is Barbara Natterson Horowitz. She wrote the book we're going to be discussing today with her co-author, Catherine Bowers. Dr. Natterson Horowitz is a MD. She earned her degrees at Harvard and the University of California in San Francisco. She's a cardiology professor at the David Gelfin School of Medicine at UCLA and serves on the medical advisory board of the Los Angeles Zoo as a cardiovascular consultant. Her writing has appeared in many scientific and medical publications, and we'd like to welcome you. Welcome, Dr. Natterson Horowitz.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So that's a mouthful. Dr. Natterson Horowitz. Is that how people address you?
Yes, that's perfect. You call me Barbara.
Oh, I will. Much easier. Okay, so you've named the book Zoobiquity, which sounds like it means there are zoos everywhere, but that's not what you meant.
No. This all started because I'm a human doctor. I take care of heart patients at UCLA, and I had for 20 years. And I was given the opportunity to come and do some ultrasounds on some of the animals at the Los Angeles Zoo that they had concerns about. And it's not an uncommon thing for zoos to make use of medical advisory boards. In any event, I went out there and I started listening to what veterinarians had to say and the kinds of diseases that they were taking care of in their patients. And I was struck by the fact that animals and humans basically get the same diseases, something I'd never really thought about before. So Catherine, my co-author, and I thought, well, what would happen if we looked at human medical problems like cancer and heart disease and diabetes and even psychiatric problems through the lens of veterinary medicine and evolution? So we decided we would coin a term that brought together two cultures, because we were bringing together the cultures of human and animal medicine. And so we brought together the word zoo, which is Greek for animal, and ubiquite, which is Latin for everywhere, and we came up with Zoobiquity.
Animals everywhere. I like it. So, lest I give away the whole purpose of the book and your entire argument with one question, how should we be looking at the causes of all of these diseases that we're all sharing since we share the same planet?
Well, it's this whole experience of being a human doctor and really looking to experts in animal health and wildlife biology to understand human health has opened my eyes to how I think about the health of my patients and my own health and my own family's health. The first part of this that was surprising to me is how many of the diseases we get, animals get, and veterinarians take care of these patients. German Shepherds and Irish Setters and other dog breeds, for example, get the same kind of tumor that recently killed Steve Jobs. There are beluga whales that get breast cancer, miniature ponies that get diabetes, koalas that have STDs, chlamydia, for example. And it goes on and on to include even behavioral syndromes. We asked, do animals get OCD? And indeed, there are dogs that get obsessive-compulsive disorder. It's called canine compulsive disorder. Dobermans are particularly prone. There are some animals that, some pigs, for example, that can have a self-starving syndrome that resembles anorexia nervosa. And there can even be sexual dysfunction in animals, for example, performance problems in stallions and such. So knowing that, first it really kind of had the effect of just expanding what I thought of as diseases that were uniquely human. As I began looking into it with Catherine, it had two effects. The first was to, as I said, expand my perspective, and the second was to really ask, well, what is the connection between environment and health, and what does that mean? So we started by asking the question about cancer. We asked, do animals get cancer? And, of course, they do. Many dog breeds are susceptible to cancer. Golden Retrievers, for example, and other breeds are susceptible to many of the same diseases that we are. We talked to many veterinarians. We learned that veterinarians are in the process of doing a prospective trial, the Morris Animal Foundation, to look at what are the environmental factors that might be contributing to cancer in dogs. Beyond that, we know that there are wild animals that do get cancer as well. We even learned something that expanded my perspective, that the fossil record indicates the evidence of cancers not only thousands of years ago, but millions of years ago. There's evidence of cancer in among dinosaurs as well. So these kinds of things just were kind of incredibly fascinating to me and mind-blowing, really.
So the presence of cancers in ancient creatures like dinosaurs, I have to think that the amount that is being seen by paleontologists is very small.
Right, and that's true. I mean, you know, they're dependent upon the fossil record, which is going to be bones. Soft tissue is gone, and you know, there are a few takeaways from the fact of ancient cancer. The first is sort of not that surprising. You know, we as humans do lots of things to amplify our risk of cancer. Our personal habits, of course. I mean, as a cardiologist and as a physician, I've spent my life taking care of patients who've smoked and eaten and, you know, drank their way into all kinds of problems. What we do, the environment, sadly, I think is amplifying our risk of cancer. But even if you stripped away all of our bad human habits, you would still have DNA that needs to replicate, mutation, and the potential for cancer. So the message is twofold. On the one hand, we amplify our risk by doing many of the things we do and contaminating our environment. But the flip side is that sometimes cancer just happens, and the presence of cancer in antiquity, I think, is speaks to that.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, Jeff Fawcett sitting by, and we're on the phone with Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD. She wrote with Catherine Bowers the book Zubiquity, Zoobiquity. A couple of comments. What occurs to me about what you're saying is that there are things that we have control over, and there are things that we don't, in terms of particularly cancer and how our DNA gets damaged. It's also clear that once DNA is damaged, it gets passed on to other generations, and that we don't have ultimate control, because there are things that we may not even realize we're being exposed to. And it also means that the propensity for cancer exists in any carbon-based living creature. And if the environment becomes polluted, even from natural causes, like possible meteorites or something like that, that could still damage DNA and still cause other things. We, of course, don't know how they fared with their cancers, whether they lived a full life despite the cancer, and whether things like that happened. But additionally, there are some lessons in not only the issue of the environment, but the issue of DNA damage and variants and inheritance in animal cancers, I think. We talked, and you talk in the book, about epigenetics, which is the relationship between the environment and cancer, the term I used that I can't remember who to give this credit to. Somebody very smart said that your genes load the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. And then we have that contrasted in your book with deep homology, which is the fact that evolution is very slow, which means that we haven't actually changed as much as we maybe would like to think. But one of the things that struck me reading your book is, especially when you look at things that dogs that are bred have in common in breed lines, is what happens to the genetic line when the breeding is restricted in that way, or when human beings, shall we say, muck about with plants and animals and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just how that affects the cancer risk.
Well, yeah, there's a lot in there. Yeah, I mean, definitely there are dog breeds that are predisposed to certain cancers, and some of that does have to do with the breeding, which is, you know, dogs are bred for certain characteristics, both, you know, physical traits and behavioral traits and sort of temperamental traits. And along with that kind of breeding, sadly, does come, yeah, the propensity for certain cancers.
And not just cancers.
Right, exactly, other diseases as well.
So I always look at all of this in terms of what are we learning about, what principles can we apply to what we've learned by looking at, I mean, to me it isn't surprising that animals and humans suffer the same diseases. That isn't surprising. It is surprising that doctors and veterinarians haven't put their heads together before this. That's surprising.
Right.
But that they suffer similarly isn't surprising because, among other things, what you've illuminated with this book is how, and I should say this is your opinion because people disagree with this, but how truly emotional animals are, and how our emotional nature, which comes out of the fact that we die and the fact that we can be prey to situations and other animals, creates or just life situations, creates a certain kind of helplessness and fear, which predisposes us to some diseases like heart disease, for instance, and that this is shared by animals. So you start the book by talking about a really important lesson that you learned about capture, giving somebody a cardiomyopathy just by looking deeply into an animal's eyes.
Right. Well, yeah, first of all, let me take a step back and sort of address something you said in your question. We tried to be very scientifically skeptical and ask each question, as I said, in a very skeptical way. So we don't actually use the term emotions when we talk about animals, but rather what we try to say is that, look, evolution plays a role in every aspect of ourselves. You know, you go to the museum and you see a skeleton, you say, well, yes, okay, we descended from, you know, X, Y, and Z animals. But, of course, every aspect of our bodies, from our physical form to our sexuality to our emotions, have emerged through a long process of natural selection. Animals with whom we share common ancestors have some of these, and different scientists call them different things. They call them survival circuits. They call them proto-emotions. So using the most conservative language, animals share with us a response to threat, danger, reproductive opportunity, many of the same functions. And we know that now because of shared neurobiology, which we now there's evidence of. So The issue of fear is a very important one. We share with animals a response to threat that is mediated through this thing called the autonomic nervous system that releases adrenaline. We call it catecholamines and other substances in response to fear. Now, that's a good thing because that can allow an animal to fight or flee, but sometimes that can overshoot, and it can lead to basically a poisoning of the muscles of the body with the catecholamine, with the adrenaline, that can sometimes lead to heart failure. And that's seen in wild animals, and there's a connected syndrome that has recently been identified in human patients, a fear or stress-induced form of heart failure. Those two shared realities, that was actually the first insight that I had, that, my goodness, veterinarians have been taking care of this problem, going by a different name, cardiomyopathy, for many decades, and we human physicians sort of came upon it in about the year 2000. And that gap just made me think that there would be so much to learn if we could collaborate with veterinarians.
Well, I hope I don't butcher the name of the human form of this. Takotsubo?
Yeah, Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. It was named
Takotsubo.
Yeah, Takotsubo. Actually, that is it's Japanese for octopus pot. And when the cardiologist in Japan, and by the way, what gives people Takotsubo cardiomyopathy are really stressful things. You know, seeing a loved one die, being stood up at the altar, losing your life savings with a roll of the dice. Those incredibly intensely stressful things can lead to this episode of acute heart failure. So it's called Takotsubo because the Japanese cardiologist who characterized it took the patients into what's called the cardiac cath lab, which is a kind of surgical suite that cardiologists use to do angiograms, and they saw that the ventricle of the heart, the pumping chamber of the heart, resembled the octopus pot that Japanese fishermen use to fish for octopus. So it's called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy.
What I would posit, there are a couple things I would posit here. I saw a study done several years back, and as I combed through it with a flea comb, you know, with a really fine-tooth comb, I realized that the study was done, the way that they conducted it, so it was done on postmenopausal women. But what they found was women were, after these heart-wrenching or heartbreaking experiences, were showing up in the emergency room with these very severe heart symptoms. In this case, they didn't see anything happening, so it may be that this was before they went as far as looking for this this problem in the ventricle. But these were non-fatal events, but they felt like heart attacks, and they were just noticing that these postmenopausal women were more at risk. Well, it turns out that menopausal women who are past menopause have lost most of the progesterone that they were making and still maintain a certain level of estrogen, which without progesterone is not heart protective at all. And estrogen does have, when you look at research, heart protective effects. But without the kind of progesterone that our bodies make, it doesn't have the calmative effects, the relaxing effects, or the sedative effects of that balances the excitatory effects of estrogen. So what I posited from that is it's likely or possible that these could have been prevented by rebalancing women's hormones with really small amounts of bioidentical progesterone. So in the same way, when I hear about some of these events, I can't think that we can protect animals in the same way, because it's hard to know. We could maybe in the future start to look at that. But the other thing is that I thought to myself, somebody comes into a hospital with these symptoms, and suddenly they're in these very extreme situations in hospitals, which are also very frightening and make you feel helpless and hyper-aroused and scared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different, you know, sort of takeaways from recognizing the similarities. For me, it's really seeing the wild animal inside of us and beginning to think. I mean, as doctors, you know, we go to these hospitals that are cathedrals of technology. And so that creates this context for the patient and the physician. I mean, it's very superhuman. But if you take a step back and then you take, you know, 300,000 steps back, you begin to see this connectedness with animals. We share, let's say, almost 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees. But if you look at mammals, we're still sharing, you know, well over 90%. The comparisons and the similarities are extreme, but we tend to focus at the tantalizing difference. And when we do that, and that's what medicine has done, human medicine has done, we it eclipses this connectedness and the shared vulnerability that we have. So we have the shared biology and the shared vulnerability. And for me, that's probably the biggest takeaway. We looked at obesity, for example. So we know, everyone knows that human beings are experiencing an obesity epidemic. And it turns out our animals are as well. Our companion animals are getting fatter. Up to 40% of our cats and dogs now are obese by criteria. There are diets that come off of the human diets. For example, there's a diet for cats called the Catkin diet, which is a low-carbohydrate, high-protein diet.
It's an Atkins diet.
Exactly. Believe it or not, there are dogs that undergo liposuction when lipomas and fatty deposits threaten to snap their spines. Animals are put on Weight Watchers point systems. I mean, as you, it goes on and on.
But they're exposed to the same toxins in the environment that we, you know, discussed, these obesogens that...
Yes. Well, those are our companion animals, and we feed them, and so a lot of our bad habits, you know, rub off on them. We don't exercise them enough. We put too much food out for them. But what was fascinating to us was to learn that there is obesity actually in wild animal populations as well. And that really opens up the possibility that obesity goes beyond diet and exercise, the typical calories in, calories out, to include environmental factors that are not only affecting us and our companion animals, but wild animals. So this is, over the years in practice, I've seen some patients who really have difficulty losing weight. And there are people who, you know, aren't really being honest, let's say, when they talk about it. But I think there are many patients who truly have cut their calories down, are trying to exercise more, and it's very challenging. And we end up saying, well, their metabolism is reduced. But there could be environmental factors that are exerting an influence that we simply aren't looking at, and those include seasonal factors, changes in day and light, darkness and light from either sky glow from cities or other factors, changes in the microbiome, which is the world of microbes that live in our intestines and our
people
skin.
Think of probiotics when they think of that, yeah.
Yes, and also antibiotics. You know, farmers feed animals antibiotics, you know, not just to treat infection. They feed them antibiotics to make them fatter, to make them gain weight.
Because they destroy the ecology of the gut, yeah.
And, you know, as we all, it's well known now that many of those antibiotics end up in our own bodies. And so I think the idea of looking for similar problems in wild animals and companion animals has the effect of instantly changing the conversation, at least asking the question, generating a new hypothesis.
Yeah, the microbiome is extraordinary because there's been there's now research that, as you say, directly connects obesity to a loss of good gut ecology. And you've also talked about the role of viruses and parasites in wild animals. Now we're finding out. You talk about, I'm trying to remember whether it was praying mantises or mosquitoes.
Dragonflies,
yeah. Who looked fine and had all these fat deposits because of some infection.
Right, and we want to be credible scientifically. We're not saying that, you know, obesity is caused by an infection. We're not saying that, you know, if you're near someone who's overweight, you're going to be overweight at all. we just want to be open to looking across the species divide for similar problems, and then in an open-minded way asking the question,
yeah.
Being open to a kind of cross-species approach. And it extends beyond obesity. We also looked at sexuality. We looked at sexually transmitted diseases. And also an area that I'm very interested in is substance seeking, because people who have problems with alcohol and substances not only have to deal with a very challenging medical problem that's very biological, they deal with shame, blame, guilt. There's so much misunderstanding of how the disease of addiction works.
Yes.
So recognizing that animals from wallabies in Tasmania who seek the poppy sap, bighorn sheep who will scale huge hills to get at lichen that are growing on rocks that have hallucinogenic properties, waxwing birds that eat these fermented berries and fly while intoxicated, learning about those naturally occurring practices of substance seeking or apparent substance seeking immediately shifted my perspective, and I immediately talked to a couple of my friends who have substance issues, and they found that normalizing in a way that they were very grateful to hear about it.
Yes, I need to break very briefly. We'll come back to this issue of pleasure seeking, which we share with other animals and which is an eye-opener also. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD. She is co-author of the book Zoobiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Health and Science of Healing. We're going to take just a brief break here. If you will, stay with us. We'll be right back with this interview.
When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you got a friend in me.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Today we are on the phone with Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD. Her book that she co-authored with Catherine Bowers is Zoobiquity. And you can visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows. Check out the changes to our library card feature and find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or contact us by email at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Barbara, did you want to give out any kind of contact information or website or anything like that?
Well, our book is called Zoobiquity, and we do have a website, zoobiquity.com.
Okay. So people can go there.
Sure.
Or to the book. Okay, so we had sort of shifted over to talking about pleasure seeking, mm-hmm. and how natural it is among animals. It doesn't look as though animals get into quite as much trouble with pleasure seeking as humans do. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if they get into trouble, but we did ask the question, do animals get, and then we extended it, do animals do? I had always assumed that we humans have sex to have babies, but largely for pleasure, and that animals had sex to procreate. But in doing our research, we quickly learned that animals have lots of non-procreative activity, from masturbation to lots and lots of same-sex encounters and beyond. So if animals are having lots of non-procreative activity, that was a real kind of eye-opener. Well, why are they doing it? And they do it, they're not going after, let's say, necessarily thinking, oh, I want to have pleasure, but pleasure does accompany probably.
Oh, it sure looks that way.
Yes. I mean, who doesn't have a dog, or who hasn't been a guest at a dinner party and have the host's dog greet your leg amorously?
Very well stated, yes.
We've had that. And animals from bats and hedgehogs, have oral sex, and bighorn sheep and bison have lots and lots of same-sex encounters that have been well documented by naturalists.
Which is very important. The presence of homosexual behavior in animals, I think, puts to bed this idea that it's not natural.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we are standing on the shoulders of giants here. Bruce Bagalmile's Biological Exuberance was a wonderful book that documented lots of same-sex practices, Marlene Zuck's wonderful book, Sexual Selections, and others. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, the spectrum of sexual activities that are seen in human beings are absolutely seen in animals, and it's time we stop saying things like X, Y, and Z is unnatural, if your definition of natural is something that happens in nature.
Yeah, the other thing that was kind of fun to read in that chapter about orgasm and sex and pleasure among animals was the remarkably similar ways that humans behave when they're in their time, how women mm-hmm. who are ovulating go out more and dress a little more, kind of more attractively to the opposite sex, how certain postures like lordosis And even the sneer that you attribute to various rock and roll stars, Elvis and all the rest, that we see on the face of a stallion when he's been enticed by a female.
Yeah, I mean, the chapter's called Roargasm. And the pun is definitely intended because, yeah, we did several things. We spent time at a stallion with stallion breeders, and we learned how stallions are, how they breed. And we learned, for example, that sometimes stallions have sexual performance problems. At the barn we visited, they have what's called a three-mount rule. They have three chances, and if it doesn't work, okay, they're going to go back to their stall for the night, and that's that. It's accepted. It's not a big deal. The veterinarians and the breeders know also that the kind of early introduction a stallion has to sexuality can have an impact on his sexual health and performance later in life. A stallion that's put with what they call a mean mare and has a bad early sexual experience can have problems later with performance. Similarly, too much sexual experience too early can also have an adverse effect. We also we learned a lot about how the females are enticed. And there was a lot that we learned about how different animals signal, females can signal receptivity or non-receptivity, and we noticed quite a few parallels with human behavior, human-female behavior. We're said as a species to have what's called concealed ovulation. So, you know, some animals, their genitals turn red, and they do all kinds of things that are very, make it very visible to the opposite sex that they're ovulating, that they're receptive. It's said that we humans, it's concealed, and while it's, you know, our genitals don't turn red, it turns out there are other signals that we may be putting out so that we're not quite as concealed as we thought.
This pleasure-seeking in animals includes other forms of pleasure like laughter, tickling, and play. You talked about panceps. Laughing rats. This came up in a show we did about laughter, about the science of laughter. And he, this researcher actually, at some point, because he wanted to be able to record to see whether there was laughter in rats, that when they liked to be tickled. In fact, when he stopped tickling, they went after his hand for more and sort of nibbled him and batted him around till he did it again. And in fact, he was able to record a sound that was hard for humans to hear, but when he slowed it down, he could hear it. One thing I'm wondering about is one of the things that gets humans into trouble, which you alluded to when you talked about a friend asking about addiction stuff, is whether or not animals become addicted or whether they just sort of get over things and move on, or whether it's mostly a human self-medication for psychiatric reasons is more human than other animals.
Right, so there are two ways that we came at this question. The first is to look at one of the most common addictions, which is actually food addiction, which is overeating. Easy access to food that's abundant in not just humans but in other animals will cause overweight. And in fact, animals in the wild, sometimes there are periods where there's an overflow of abundance and there are not that many predators around, and in those periods, animals will overconsume and they will gain weight. The difference is their environment shifts into periods of scarcity. And so that weight goes up and goes down. And in the animal world, and among veterinarians know, that a dynamic weight, a weight that shifts somewhat, is normal. But in our environment, we have easy access to abundant food, but our environment doesn't change. It's maintained in this sort of non-dynamic place. And so, of course, our weight goes up and up and up. The other area that we looked at this question is substance seeking, and also we really wanted to understand behavioral addiction in humans from a veterinary perspective. So if you look at the most common behavioral addictions in humans, sex addiction, food addiction, gambling, you see that these behaviors are very fitness enhancing, and I'm using the term fitness from an evolutionary perspective. They increase the likelihood of reproduction and of survival. So it actually does make sense that the things that we do compulsively, we do because they give us pleasure, and they give us pleasure probably because from an evolutionary perspective, fitness-enhancing behaviors are rewarded with pleasure so as to reinforce them.
Yeah, the problem is that industry has discovered this evolutionary behavior, and they're, you mentioned yourself in the book about how people become addicted to their wireless devices and their little squirts of dopamine, pleasure chemicals, and actually become anxious and shaky when they can't get to their iPhone to check their emails. So it's
You're exactly right. The most successful injuries industry.
It is an injury. Yes.
Injurious injuries industry are those industries that tap into those ancient evolutionary circuits. I mean, that's the brilliance of the drug market, both illegal drugs and non-illegal drugs. I mean, those drugs go right into those circuits, and they tell the animal or the human animal that they've accomplished that fitness enhancing behavior when they haven't. Why spend 30 minutes chit-chatting at an office with uncomfortable chit-chat in an office cocktail party when you can drink two martinis and have the feeling that you've already done that.
Mm-hmm. So, not to belabor it, but did you see non-human animals having the same problem with addiction as human animals?
No, because there's not the same access.
Right.
I mean, there was a story that was told on NPR about a cocker spaniel. So this is a companion animal that became addicted to the toads.
Yes, that's a very funny story.
The skin of the toads in the backyard had a hallucinogenic, probably euphorogenic substance, and this little cocker spaniel started licking and just wanted to get out of the house and keep compulsively licking the toads. Well, there was a constant supply of toads. In the wild, that is not the case. And again, we want to be careful. We don't know that the animals are seeking the substances to get high. That would be irresponsible to say. But naturalists have noticed this behavior among, as I said, wallabies, bighorn sheep, various birds. And so we think it's actually irresponsible not to at least ask the question, what are they going after?
One of the other things that I found interesting in the book is the similarity between animal behavior that goes wrong based on frightening events that trains the animal into a kind of helpless or frightened state, and they begin to become hyperactive and start pushing beyond their limits when they feel helpless and frightened. And when I work with individuals, one of the things that I've seen for many years is this sort of trading addictions and becoming addicted to exercise and then suddenly pushing the body beyond its limits. We also see this with anorexia nervosa, where people become frightened and anxious to a point where it expresses itself or presents itself in terms of how they interact with their environment. And maybe at the root of it is a sense of helplessness and fear.
Yeah, I mean, animals, one of the questions that we asked is, do animals faint? And many people faint in response to very stressful things. It typically is a little bit more common in younger folks and in girls than boys, but it's called vasovagal syncope, but syncope is the medical term for fainting. And we see people fainting, for example, sometimes when they have blood drawn, when they have extreme pain, like a long bone fracture, when they get terrible news. People who have to give bad news or sometimes have, in emergency rooms. Fathers sometimes in delivery suites will faint. So extreme emotion can sometimes lead to faint. So we asked, do animals faint? And what we learned is that sometimes, yes, they do. But it turns out that the physiology that leads to fainting in response to stress is actually a survival physiology that allows an animal to hide. Because what happens, whether it's in human beings or in, rodents or voles or fish, is that a high adrenaline state can actually lead to a marked reduction in heart rate, which leads to essentially fainting. And in fish, for example, the slowing of the heart rate and the fact that makes the fish quiet and not moving can actually have anti-predation benefit. So the takeaway from that chapter is that fighting or fleeing your enemy can work some of the time, but when fighting is futile and fleeing is not an option, sometimes just being still offers a pretty powerful form of protection.
Let me just say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. We are on the phone today with Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD, her book, Zubiquity. So, yeah, how does this relate to humans?
Well, the fact that sometimes being still can be a saving grace, I think is important medically, but I think it's also something that we are coming to realize that that piece of advice, you know, when you don't know what to do, do nothing, it may be rooted in ancient fish physiology.
Well, in addition, many people maladapt by becoming what I call a moving target. In other words, they are too anxious and frightened to stop moving. They maintain this kind of, they don't stop, they don't recover, and they damage their health. I mean, we see these cases of young athletes with a horrible heart disease, and we see other people who are meaning to make their health better, but they're over-exercising and pushing themselves so hard that their body breaks down, because what's beneficial at a certain level with enough recovery, and that's the key point, is the recovery, because our stress... Mm-hmm. Our stress system, our adrenaline and catecholamines work in a sort of peak and valley sort of thing. So without recovery, we damage the very system that we're trying to train to be healthier. So I think that we see this both with the behavior of people becoming workaholics, exerciseaholics, people who don't sleep, people who drive themselves very hard, and then I think that there's a dovetail into anorexia as well, as another fear-based adaptation.
Yeah, you know, when you talk to patients who have eating disorders, and anorexia nervosa is one, you hear a lot about anxiety. Fear and anxiety are very connected. In fact, anxiety disorders, whether it's generalized anxiety, OCD, or other, or panic, are very associated with anorexia nervosa. So we were wondering, well, what is the animal origin of that connection? And we studied a number of different, we came about at this in a number of different ways. One of the things we learned is that the elk and deer in certain regions in the United States, when predators are removed, when either there was culling of predators, for example, the deer and elk relax their eating. They ate more, they ate for longer periods of time. They ate during periods of the day that they never would have eaten before, and they started to gain weight. When the predators were brought back, their eating became more restricted. They ate fewer types of food at fewer periods of time. The connection, we think, to anorexia nervosa may be that the more, quote-unquote, predators there are, the more fear there are in a patient, there is in a patient's life, the more restricted their eating becomes. And I trained as a psychiatrist before I trained in cardiology, and I did spend time working with patients with anorexia nervosa. And I, in writing this book, I thought, my goodness, what if I had been able to talk with my patients about identifying the wolves in their lives and learning about how wild animal eating is affected by the presence of threat?
I think it's a very important connection, and you cite other ones, other examples of this. But the other thing that it kind of dovetails into is something that I wanted to talk to you about, which is teens and risky behavior, is the role of conformity. And, you know, teens are really conform very much, and they don't treat the ones that don't conform very well. And it's nicer if you think of it as a flock of birds who can't, have to be in synchronization with each other, or you are a red flag for a predator, so you need to synchronize. So it's nicer to think of it that way. I mean, it doesn't make me feel ultimately better about it, but it helps. So in the same way, anorexics also are trying to conform to a certain beauty standard that's being pushed.
Yeah, I mean, looking at adolescence and adolescent behavior through the lens of veterinary medicine and animal behavior was also eye-opening. The first thing that we came upon was the risk-taking that we're all worried about in teenagers, and that has been so pathologized, happens in other animals as well. It turns out that the neurobiology that drives, you know, novelty-seeking, sensation-seeking, all of the traits that adolescents have that lead to the increased rate of accidental injury and death is shared by other animals, and for good reason. an animal needs to take risks when it's in that phase between being a juvenile and being an independent, autonomous adult. It needs to take risks to disperse, to leave that natal group, to find its own resources. And so there's neurobiology that drives that behavior. We spent time with a marine mammal biologist who works with sea otters up in near Monterey. She told us that there's an area off the coast of Monterey that is it's a very dangerous area for sea otters. There's not much kelp there for the otters to hide from predators. There are many, many sharks. There's a high incidence of toxo. It's a dangerous area. The adult sea otters won't go there. The children don't go there. The juveniles don't go there. The women don't go there. The only sea otters that go there are the adolescent males, mm-hmm. the daredevils of the sea otter world.
Yeah, it's a great image. When I got a new kitten, and when he reached adolescence, he began to follow me deep into the woods on hikes. And I kept trying to discourage him because there are people walking dogs in the woods that are unleashed, so I don't really want, you know, that kind of an encounter. But he kept insisting, and nothing I could do would stop him. And now I've noticed that as he's gotten to be an adult, he no longer will go all the way. He'll go to a certain point and then cry piteously for me to come back. So that behavior changes. It's really interesting to see how what role it plays. It's a fascinating aspect of learning. In addition, there's another way of, you know, in the same way that conformity, you can look at schools of fish and birds and see how when they fly in formation, that's protective in terms of not being picked off by a predator.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives us a context for bullying and hierarchy where people are pushing and jockeying for a bigger position. I don't think that animal. I don't know. There is a lot of hierarchical behavior, especially mm-hmm. among primates and other animals as well. And mm-hmm. it isn't pleasant to think about. But they usually don't fight to the death. But there is this problem with bullying, and it may be that there is a certain naturalness to it, even though we would prefer that we evolved a little past it.
Yeah, it was interesting that bullying is such an important problem, and it's really wonderful that it's being identified in schools now as an issue and addressed as really a medical problem, which it is, because it devastates the mental health of kids particularly who are affected. And it turns out that there's a lesson we can learn from a number of animals. The aggression by a dominant onto a subdominant is the model that we think is very relevant, because it turns out many bullies are actually popular kids. They're kids who feel pretty good about themselves. And that's counter to what we used to think, which is, you know, the bully has poor self-esteem. But it turns out some bullying happens by kids who are kind of high on the social hierarchy. So the question is, well, why does a kid who's high on the social hierarchy need to aggress against one that has less social status? And so turning to animal groups, you see this behavior fairly frequently. And naturalists, wildlife biologists, believe that a dominant aggresses on a subdominant to demonstrate his dominance, his position, to act as a kind of signal to the rest of the group, don't try to challenge me, I'm on top. It's just a different way of thinking about bullying. This year, we're actually going to have a conference, Zubiquity Conference. We did one last year where we brought veterinarians together with physicians to discuss the shared problems across species. And this year, we are going to look at bullying in humans and in animal groups.
It sounds good. It reminds me of the research of Robert Sapolsky at Stanford, who studies baboons in Kenya, and baboons behave very much the way humans do, in other words, poorly, for the most part. And he noticed that some of the males have opted out of the hierarchical behavior,
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to get beaten up, and they don't want to be at the top and then be kicked off the top and be beaten up and all of that. So what they do is they hang out with the girls,
yeah.
the women, baboons, and they get groomed a lot, and in fact they end up having more sex than any of the other baboons. So it is possible to learn. You know, I think it is possible to learn. I think there's hope.
And it's not just great apes, and it's not just primates, and it's not just mammals. We learned that the NASCAR boobies, these birds, that's a great name. I know. When you go to the Galapagos, you learn about the boobies, the beautiful birds. But there's a kind of transgenerational form of abuse that happens where the boobies that are bullied become the bulliers of the next generation.
And yeah, that's familiar, isn't it? That we
mm-hmm.
see that in humans for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it looks like some animals, like elephants, the mature animals hang out with the adolescents to help them through this risky behavior period, huh?
Yeah, again, we try to be careful about using language like mentoring and being, you know, overly connecting. But it does look like animals, from condors to elephants, during these adolescent years, which can be, or in some cases not years, in some animals, the transition from juvenile to adult can literally last, you know, an hour or two. But that the presence of models, sometimes same-sex models in groups, can be very, very important. We were told the story of some condor who followed an immature mentor, and that didn't go very well. But it is interesting that the tendency for that phase of life, for an individual in that phase of life, among certain animals, we're not talking about all animals, of course, to follow a leader is strong.
Incidentally, I think that the preponderance of scientists not wanting to use certain terms in relationship to animal because it's anthropomorphic is part of the original break from nature, you know.
Totally.
Where we, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So. No, I was taught in my education, do not anthropomorphize. That was a scientific crime, intellectually bankrupt. That was a sign that I was sentimental, I was projecting. And, you know, I was an A student. I didn't want to do any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So starting from that perspective, you know, years later into this research and writing this book, I think the much greater risk is under-anthropomorphizing. I mean, what we're doing, but what we're doing is we're ignoring the genetic fact of our connectedness. Add to that the shared environmental perspective. All arrows, in my mind, point to tremendously more collaboration with veterinarians, wildlife biologists, and ecologists.
Mm-hmm. So let's end on this theme. You have in the book a description of how people are bringing their companion animals into researchers and letting them be used, if they have some pathology, being used in clinical trials. And this is a way that we can learn from animal studies without trapping and torturing animals. So I think this is speaking to a new trend, which I think is very helpful.
Yeah, it's a new opportunity. You know, it's animals every day all around us get sick. Babies are born with birth defects. Viruses happen. Bacteria happen. Cancer happens. Trauma happens. This is happening naturally, and we physicians have all but ignored that reality. We're talking about hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of mammals today with four-chambered beating hearts, not to mention reptiles and fish. We need to reach across the species divide, be colleagues with veterinarians, wildlife biologists, and others. And, you know, they have so much to teach us. I've become a better doctor by working with veterinarians who do think, I think, more ecologically about disease, who think more about the group and the effect of the group on the individual. So, yes, I think that's an opportunity for us to learn about animals that way.
Well, Barbara Natterson Horowitz, M.D., her novel Zubiquity, we will put a link on our website to your website. Thank you so much for the research and the book and the interview today.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows. Check out the changes to our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.